This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll talk with Western Michigan University doctoral student Tom Ratgos, one of the organizers of this month's Michigan Autism Conference in Kalamazoo. But first, the Girl Scouts Heart of Michigan says it is focusing its efforts more on structural and cultural sexism. The new initiative is called Equality for Girls, and we're joined by the CEO of the Girl Scouts Heart of Michigan, Jan Barker. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Let's introduce you, maybe more accurately say, reintroduce you to our audience and remind people about your career going through Girl Scouts.
Well, I've been with Girl Scouts now since 1995. And in Southwest Michigan, we were originally Girl Scouts of Glowing Embers, of which I was a CEO for 13 years. And prior to that, some of our listeners may remember I actually worked for MSU Extension Service as a 4-H agent for 15 years. So I have a lot of 4-H folks to thank for really getting me introduced to the community, especially agricultural community. But also, they taught me so much about what I know about volunteer management. And then in 2008, there was a mandatory realignment, and there were five councils from across the state that we merged with Glowing Embers. And so we now have a headquarters here in Kalamazoo on Maple Street in Crosstown. We also have offices in Jackson, Lansing, Ipsy Ann Arbor, and Saginaw. So we go from Higgins and Houghton Lake all the way around the thumb to the beautiful Great Lakes Bay region, and then back across all the way over to Saugatuck and South Haven. We serve 19,000 girls and 6,000 leaders.
So a big swath of Michigan is covered within that particular umbrella.
Yes. Mainly my office is in my car because I do travel from office to office and really work with staff and volunteers all across the state.
So explain to us a little bit now about this focus on gender equality. I assume that people have always kind of seen Girl Scouts as having that as part of its mission. Would you say that now you're taking on that as a larger focus of what you're going to do?
Yes, I think what's happened for 100 years plus, Girl Scouts has been this powerful dynamic force to break a lot of barriers for girls. And we've talked to a lot of folks out in the community and discovered that when our girls leave Girl Scouting, oftentimes they go to a place where they might not have a level playing field. And so what we want to do is talk with the community. We want to share how important that equality and equity is for girls and women, talk about how unequal it still is in many arenas. And then we want to teach our leaders and our girls how to better understand the gender inequity and how to analyze it. And we want to really teach our girls how to buffer it, how to keep it from happening so they can arrive at a safe and successful place in their future.
Is there anything that you would say was a tipping point here that got people thinking that this was something that needed to be done? Or is it just maybe a lack of action, that you didn't see the movement that you thought there should have been towards gender equality?
There were numerous tipping points. First of all, Girl Scouts is a large business. And a lot of times when I will introduce myself, people will ask me, oh, do you have any cookies I can buy? So there's huge inequity and misunderstanding, misinterpreted when people talk about Girl Scouts as a business. And so that has been constant. Then our girls really speak out to us and say, why don't we have 50% at the minimum representation in the legislature? Why are there only 6 women governors in the United States? Now, here's the good news. 5 of them were Girl Scouts. So we've been so successful. But another example that really hit us in the face is the highest award that a girl can be honored with in Girl Scouts, and she works very hard to do that, is called the Girl Scout Gold Award. And hardly anyone knows about that. They're very familiar with what the Boy Scouts organization awards to boys. But we have for years kind of been under a big, large glass ceiling. And I think it's a thicker glass ceiling than we as individual women have bumped up against. And so we experience that on a regular basis.
I want to break this down just a little bit, maybe see what we're talking about. One, you know, you mentioned here that we're talking about structural sexism, cultural sexism. Let's start with structural. What exactly is there that's in the way structurally of true gender equality?
Well, most of our misconceptions often come from our most intimate, closest relationships. So often in families, we will hear in some of our communities, parents that will say, or grandparents, well, we don't necessarily want our daughter to go away to college. We might not get grandchildren, or it's important that she learns to cook and clean, and if she's educated, that's a bonus. We still hear those things from some family members, and I think they're ingrained, and when girls hear that, you just can't help but think that that might be a reality. So I think also it's ingrained in the media, where the ideal body type is not many that most girls and women can emulate. And I'm not sure that's fair. We know that girls, when they're 10 years of age, 70% of girls are afraid of being fat. By the time they hit middle school, 40 to 70% of the girls are dislike or dissatisfied with two parts of their body. And by the time they're in high school, many of them are completely dissatisfied with their body. And that leads to depression, anxiety, self-confidence. And what Girl Scouts does is also an equality within the culture, but equality that, you know what, we're for all girls becoming successful and finding their full potential. So that's some of the structural.
So what would you say, you know, culturally and socially, what are the things that might fall under those categories?
Well, I think back again, I may have misspoke earlier, but the media is a social influence. We know that often girls are that are involved in sexual assault or threatening violent experiences are often the victims, and the victim is blamed, so there's some victim blame. I think a great example of gender inequity is the gender pay gap. Women make about 79 cents for every dollar men do doing equivalent work. And often women are routinely passed over for promotions and challenging assignments. So that's ingrained in our culture also. I think often there are things promoted as boy-type activities and men-type careers, and those are the exact things that we're going to address.
There's some very different things that I think we've just covered here in the last couple minutes. You know, one is, you know, women getting paid the same as men or not getting paid the same as men as the current case may be. Then there's, of course, hiring practices at companies. You also mentioned women running for elected office. I suppose those are things that all have to be addressed in different ways, aren't they? I mean, you know, when we talk about pay, that could be legislation. If we're talking about hiring practices, maybe that's something where you examine how companies are screening people. And I suppose, how do you convince people who are out there voting that they should be voting for more women? Because that's ultimately what has to happen to get more women elected to office, right?
We could also have way more women running. That could help. We're going to be talking with our girls about what are the leadership skills to run for the legislature. Right now, if you look at our national government, 19% of the legislators in the House of Representatives are women, even though we make up 50% of the population. Now, the good news is 54% of those were Girl Scouts. We know that if a girl is a Girl Scout, she has a way better chance of falling into and landing into a leadership position in her womanhood. We're going to intentionally talk about these things. We're going to talk about how important it is to get girls aware of the skills they need to be in government, get them excited. Many women politicians run because someone suggests they should. We want the girls to really be self-confident enough to say, I think I could run this section of government. I think I could perform this civic duty. We also want to make sure that the girls understand and can analyze some of the gender biases that are out there and to be able to reject them. Another scary statistic, Gordon, is girls are often at risk at college camp on college campuses for assault and rape or attempted rape. And girls have told us that they want to be able to talk about that in a way so they could better understand it, protect themselves. I think that if we can talk about that with everyone, and Girl Scouts is the largest organization for women, we're the perfect organization to really address some of these trickier, threatening topics. But I believe that if we talk about it, we can be more aware of it. Everyone will have it on their radar, and that girls indeed will be safer then. But girls have told us they want to talk about it. They want to talk about assault. I mean, 1 in 3 women are threatened, interpersonally threatened, at some point in their lifetime. And we want to talk about that.
Do you vary this somewhat by age? I guess I'm wondering, you know, what's the right time at which to start talking about something like sexual assault on campus?
Girl Scouts is a wonderful opportunity for girls kindergarten through 12th grade. So we will have a progression of experiences that we'll talk. So obviously you would talk differently to a third grader than you would 11th grader. I've spent a lot of time interviewing high school girls. They're the ones that are really interested just before they leap into higher ed or before they go on to another career that they want to talk about it. Our younger girls, we're going to talk to them about age-appropriate subjects, which is something that people don't think about Girl Scouts often is that we have an intensive adult education program, and this is really exciting. We're going to do several things within Girl Scouting to affect a change about girls and equality. One is that we're asking girls to get involved in helping to train the leaders and volunteers, especially train them about how to be girl-led. And what does it feel for a girl, how empowering it is when a leader will really design the curriculum and the activities so that it's really girl-led. So we want girls to teach leaders how to do that. We want girls to also be involved in the strategic planning of the council. So administratively and tactically, I'm going to personally be working with girls, which is an exciting thing for me. It doesn't happen very often, but we're going to change that up. The other thing we're going to do is offer very bold programs for girls. We want girls that when they're at a robotics class, that they're not sitting beside a boy that has had electronics, so they feel instantly behind. That's a cultural and structural disadvantage that sometimes, you know, a boy might say, well, I know how to do this. I took electronics. And we're going to try to figure all those things that will help our girls really have an equal seat at the table.
So how big a change would you say this is at the troop level, you know, at the level of, you know, the girl in third grade or fifth grade or 11th grade, et cetera, who has been a Girl Scout and or plans to be a Girl Scout in the future? How big a change will this be in sort of the week-to-week activities that a Girl Scout troop normally undertakes?
Well, we've rolled this out with all of our community volunteers. We have very key volunteers called area managers. They're volunteers that run their community. Like, for example, sections of Kalamazoo, there's an area manager. They were the first to hear about the program and to begin to talk to the leaders within their communities about the program. This entire year, we're going to be revamping our adult and volunteer training. And we're hoping that it will get to the troop level. We are engaging girls. In fact, we'd love to come back and bring some girls to do an additional interview because we are training a press corps of girls to really share the message and give you their perspective, which is very fascinating. And then we also are going to be offering many, many, many additional programs. So our program team is designing those this year with the help of girls working right alongside and, of course, volunteer troop leaders. Now, the important thing to remember about Girl Scouts is there are lots of ways a girl can join. She can be part of a classic troop. She can go to camp. We are the experts in girls in the outdoors, which is so critical for a girl's health. She can go on a travel experience. She can participate in council-sponsored programs. We offer more than 200 this year, and they're going to get bolder. So lots of ways. But our troop leaders, we're going to really work with them to bring them closer. We have 6,000 troop leaders across our 34 counties, and it's going to take us a little while to transfer this knowledge. But I think within the next 1 to 3 years, the information, the news should be out there. And I'm hoping that everyone in Michigan understands that Girl Scouts are really advocates and strong promoters of equality for girls.
Is this in part about the next generation of leaders, not only within the Girl Scouts, but beyond that, that you're wanting to bring about the next generation who forges the trail for those who follow?
Well, that's our constant business. We've been doing that for years. Every astronaut that has flown in space was a Girl Scout. And Girl Scout is sort of this silent group of women that know that they got lots of powerful competencies and leadership skills in the past, but the world doesn't know it. So what I'm hoping is that the world can suddenly understand what a powerfully dynamic organization Girl Scouts is to train women. There's another aspect of that that I think is very exciting is that we are assertively welcoming men into the organization. Many men do not know that they can be leaders. And some of our biggest, boldest advocates for girls are men. And so we're going to be inviting many more men into our organization to serve as leaders because 1 in 5 children does not have a positive male role model in their life. And that concerns us. And we think that we need to add more men to our volunteer ranks.
Do you also hope that one of the byproducts here is that girls who perhaps to this point have not been interested in Girl Scouts now find it more interesting and find this message appealing and may decide to join?
We certainly hope that girls that don't know much about Girl Scouting will see how absolutely extraordinary it is. It's so fun. And we also hope that it welcomes in new volunteers. I'm most often told by volunteers they had no idea that they were going to learn more than the girls. So it's this caring, trusting, safe place to learn and try new things and become equal and really strive for doing anything that your heart might imagine in Girl Scouts. It's pretty fun. It's way fun. And for our girls, the focus is it's a lot of fun and it's a chance to make a whole new group of friends.
Jan Barker, thank you for your time.
You are very welcome. It was a pleasure to be here.
Jan Barker is CEO of the Girl Scouts Heart of Michigan. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The annual Michigan Autism Conference is being held in Kalamazoo September 14th through the 16th. Tom Ratkos is one of the organizers of the conference for parents and professionals. He's also a doctoral student at Western Michigan University. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Gordon. Great to be here.
So a year later, we talked with you about this time last year when the conference was about to begin. But autism is an evolving field. What is new this year that you'll be talking about?
I think what we've done this year is bring together an even wider group of experts. Experts include parents and actually individuals with autism themselves. Anthony Iani is a Michigan celebrity of sorts. He was diagnosed at 4 and went on to get a couple of Big Ten championships up at State and graduate from there. And he's one of our keynote speakers on Friday. So he's a really inspirational figure for all of us, professionals and parents alike, that we can really have hope that with the best treatment and quality people around individuals, that they can really achieve everything they want to.
Anthony Iani's now working with the Michigan Department of Civil Rights, and he goes around the country talking about bullying. How big a problem is bullying for a child that has autism?
Bullying is a huge issue. Every kid experiences bullying to some extent. But for our children with autism, they find it even more difficult to navigate the social milieu of their school. And they're at a greater risk of being victimized by bullying. What Anthony is doing is great for those individuals, building awareness. But these kids need to know the bullies and other kids that may not be bullies, but then they see a kid that is a little different. The more awareness we can get of the struggles that these kids face, the better off we'll all be.
The state has been reviewing special education policies and procedures, and of course, this has applied in some cases to students with autism. You know, if you were the guy who had to lay out the best way to educate a child with autism, what would you say would be the best way for the state to move forward?
Well, the state's doing a lot of great things towards moving towards best practices. And for our kids with autism, a real individualized approach is necessary. And part of that is making sure that everyone involved in the child's education is up to date on the best practices available. And this conference really does a lot to do that. We bring together a lot of different professionals. And at its heart, the Michigan Autism Conference is really a meeting of the minds of the best experts, and we learn from each other. There's a lot of conferences that are very narrow focused. I go to a lot myself, but this one really brings together all sorts of different types of professionals, from the parents who have their own expertise to individuals themselves, to dentists that work with autism, to special education teachers, researchers, and we really do learn from each other to figure out what's best for these individuals.
One of the things that you told us when we talked to you last year is that if you know one student with autism, you know one student with autism.
That's right.
That there is a great variation from one student to the next. And of course, it's called autism spectrum, the autism spectrum,
right.
Because there's a wide range of how students may interact and how they may learn, et cetera. Does that complicate the process then of trying to come up with guidelines to say this is the best way to educate or to treat a student who has autism?
It does. It can't be a cookie cutter approach. And one of the things that every individual with any disability has is an individualized education plan. And it really needs to be that, not just in name, but it really needs to be people who know what the difficulties and strengths of these students are that come together every year and plan out an individualized education plan for these students. And it can't be the same for each one.
Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly has really been a person at the forefront of this issue. He has a child with autism.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help bring an issue like this to light when you have people who have the spotlight and have the opportunity to speak in public and to perhaps move public policy, who have some personal experience with the issue?
Yeah, that's huge. I mean, for me, it's a parallel between John F. Kennedy, and who had a sister that was had a developmental disability, and he saw firsthand the struggles therein and the lack of services and really what was going wrong with how the country at large dealt with those types of issues. So having a politician in our state that really knows what's going on and really sees it at the parent level and at the personal level, it's huge for us. We're so happy to have Lieutenant Governor Kelly as an ally in this fight to make things better for those people. And he's been a speaker for us in the past. He's still a huge supporter, and we really appreciate his support.
So you mentioned earlier that you want to always focus on best practices, but as we've also discussed, autism is still the sort of evolving field. So how much of a grasp is there right now on what the best practices are for dealing with a child who has autism?
That's a great question. Being individualized in your approach is key, but that doesn't mean you can throw in everything but the kitchen sink. There are things that have been proven to work better or work worse. So one thing that I focus on in my work is taking a function-based approach to problem behavior that occurs with students and adults even. One expert in that area is Dr. Stephanie Peterson. She's a trained special education teacher, but she's also the chair of the department at Western Michigan University. And she's doing a free kickoff event on the 14th for parents, titled Strategies Parents Can Use to Minimize Problem Behavior. And really taking a function-based approach is one of those best practices. But that in itself is not one technique. It means really doing an individualized assessment for the individual and making sure that what we do to intervene, it really fits their needs.
You just mentioned they're adults, and we've been talking about children a lot, but autism does not go away when you go into adulthood. So I guess I'm wondering, you know, we see a lot about children. Should we maybe see a little more about adults? Is that an area which deserves some more focus?
Certainly. There's no question about it. Michigan is in a really good place because we go beyond what's federally necessary to support special education students. Michigan supports those students all the way to 26. And a lot of that is focused on transitioning from, okay, you go to school every day, to how are we going to make you the most independent and successful person you can be. But of course, at 26, they don't stop needing services either. People who were unsuccessful with different treatments or who never had access to those treatments, they often find themselves in group homes, or they live at home with their aging parents for a long time. And there are an increasing number of services that are there for those people, but there definitely needs to be more.
I mean, you mentioned access to treatment, but might this also just be influenced on where you are on that autism spectrum in terms of where you might end up later in life?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, when someone's diagnosed at two or three, there's really no telling what the trajectory is and what impact different interventions or different therapy styles will have on that individual. We find a lot of kids make huge gains. Most kids make significant gains, and there's a small amount of the population that we find we have to fight for every inch. And a lot of research is going into how do we serve those kids that aren't currently seeing the gains that others are. And a lot of it is still a mystery, but we're chipping away at it bit by bit.
Western Michigan University now has an autism center, which is involved in research and all those sort of things. How much difference does that make for someone like you, a doctoral student at the university?
Well, the state has made a lot of resources available, and that Autism Center of Excellence is a huge deal for all of us in the department. We get the chance to go in and have the resources necessary to help these people, and we see everything that can be done. And when our education is done, we can take those lessons with us and teach others or go off into the world and continue helping people.
So how many people are you expecting to attend this year's Michigan Autism Conference?
We are looking at about 500 people, and it's really going to be a great event.
And if someone is out there and thinking, well, is this the sort of thing that I should be interested in? Who are you looking at? Who would you say is your real target audience?
We've constructed our schedule to really put forth talks, breakout sessions, workshops for a real wide variety of people. We have a track of talks specifically aimed at parents. We have tracks specifically designed for special education teachers. Certainly, there'll be a lot of behavior analysts there. One of our keynote speakers, Bruce Thayer, is a social worker who takes a behavior analytic approach. And so we have these intended audiences, but I think one of the cool things is how wide the scope is of this conference, that we're all talking about autism and we all are coming together to best help these people, but we're really learning from each other.
Tom Ratgos, thank you for your time.
All right, thank you.
Tom Ratgos is a doctoral student at Western Michigan University and also one of the organizers of the Michigan Autism Conference, which is being held September 14th through the 16th in Kalamazoo. You can find links with more information at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.